What about Glass?
What about him, boy? You become a doctor while we've been camping here? There's nothing we can do now.
We can do what we're supposed to be doing, wait with him, and bury him when he dies. That was our deal with the captain.
Scrape out a grave if it'll make you feel better. Hell, build him a goddamn altar. But if I come back here and that meat's not ready, I'll whip on you till you're worse off than him.
Fitzgerald grabbed his rifle and disappeared down the creek. The day was typical of early September. Sunny and crisp in the morning, hot by afternoon. The terrain flattened where the creek met the river, its trickling waters spreading wide across a sandbar before joining the rushing current of the Grand. Fitzgerald's eyes were drawn downward to the scattered tracks of the Fur Brigade, still apparent after 4 days. He glanced upriver, where an eagle perched like a sentry on the bare branch of a dead tree. Something startled the bird. It opened its wings, and with two powerful flaps lifted itself from its perch. Carving a neat pivot on the tip of its wing, the bird turned and flew upriver. The screaming whinny of a horse cut the morning air. Fitzgerald spun around. The morning sun sat directly on the river, its piercing rays merging with water to form a dancing sea of light. Squinting against the glare, Fitzgerald could discern the silhouettes of mounted Indians. He dropped to the ground. Did they see me? He lay on the ground for an instant, his breath arriving in staccato spurts. He snaked toward the only cover available, a scrubby stand of willows. Listening intently, he heard again the whinny of the horse, but not the churning pound of charging horses. He checked to ensure his rifle and pistol were charged, removed his wolfskin hat, and lifted his head to peer through the willows. There were 5 Indians at a distance of about 200 yards on the opposite bank of the Grand. 4 of the riders formed a loose semicircle around the 5th, who quartered a balking pinto. 2 of the Indians laughed, and all of them seemed transfixed by the struggle with the horse. 1 of the Indians wore a full headdress of eagle feathers. Fitzgerald was close enough to see clearly a bear claw necklace around his chest and the otter pelts that wrapped his braids. 3 of the Indians carried guns, the other 2, bows. There was no war paint on the men or the horses, and Fitzgerald guessed they were hunting. He wasn't sure of the tribe, although his working assumption was that any Indians in the area would view the trappers with hostility. Fitzgerald calculated that they were just beyond rifle range. That would change quickly if they charged. If they came, he would have 1 shot with the rifle and 1 with the pistol. He might be able to reload his rifle once if the river slowed them down. 3 shots at 5 targets. He didn't like the odds. Belly to the ground, Fitzgerald wormed his way toward the cover of the higher willows near the creek. He crawled through the middle of the brigade's old tracks, cursing the markings that so clearly betrayed their position. He turned again when he reached the thicker willows, relieved that the Indians remained preoccupied with the stubborn pinto. Still, they would arrive at the confluence of the creek with the river in a matter of instants. They would notice the creek, and then they would notice the tracks, the goddamn tracks, pointing like an arrow up the creek. Fitzgerald worked his way from the willows to the pines. He pivoted to take 1 final look at the hunting party. The skittish pinto had settled, and all 5 Indians now continued up the river. We have to leave now. Fitzgerald ran up the creek the short distance to the camp. Bridger was pounding venison against a stone when Fitzgerald burst into the clearing. There's 5 bucks coming up the Grand. Fitzgerald began wildly stuffing his few possessions into his pack. He looked up suddenly, his eyes focused in intensity and fear, then anger. Move, boy! They'll be on our tracks any minute! Bridger stuffed meat into his parfleche. Next, he threw his pack and possible's bag over his shoulders, then turned to grab his rifle, leaning against a tree next to Glass's Anstatt. Glass. The full implication of flight struck the boy like a sudden sobering slap. He looked down at the wounded man. For the first time that morning, Glass's eyes were open. As Bridger stared down, the eyes initially had the glassy, uncomprehending gaze of one awakening from deep sleep. The longer Glass stared, the more his eyes seemed to focus. Once focused, it was clear that the eyes stared back with complete lucidity, clear that Glass, like Bridger, had calculated the full meaning of the Indians on the river. Every pore in Bridger's body seemed to pound with the intensity of the moment, yet to Bridger it seemed that Glass's eyes conveyed a serene calmness. Understanding? Forgiveness? Or is that just what I want to believe? As the boy stared at Glass, guilt seized him like clenched fangs. What does Glass think? What will the captain think? You sure they're coming up the creek? Bridger's voice cracked as he said it. He hated the lack of control, the demonstrable weakness in a moment demanding strength. Do you want to stay and find out? Fitzgerald moved to the fire, grabbing the remaining meat from the drying racks. Bridger looked again at Glass. The wounded man worked his parched lips, struggling to form words through a throat rendered mute. He's trying to say something. The boy knelt, struggling to understand. Glass slowly raised his hand and pointed a shaking finger. He wants the Anstalt. He wants his rifle. He wants us to set him up with his rifle. The boy felt the blunt pain of a forceful kick against his back and found himself lying face down on the ground. He struggled to his hands and knees, looking up at Fitzgerald. The rage on Fitzgerald's face seemed to merge with the distorted features of the wolfskin hat. Move, goddamn you! Bridger scrambled to his feet, wide-eyed and startled. He watched as Fitzgerald walked to Glass, who lay on his back, with his few possessions piled next to him. A possible's bag, a knife in a beaded scabbard, a hatchet, the Anstalt, and a powder horn. Fitzgerald stooped to pick up Glass's possible's bag. He dug inside for the flint and steel, dropping them into the pocket on the front of his leather tunic. He grabbed the powder horn and slung it over his shoulder. The hatchet he tucked under his broad leather belt. Bridger stared, uncomprehending. What are you doing? Fitzgerald stooped again, picked up Glass's knife, and tossed it to Bridger.
Take that.
Bridger caught it, staring in horror at the scabbard in his hand. Only the rifle remained. Fitzgerald picked it up, checking quickly to ensure it was charged.
Sorry, old Glass. You ain't got much more use for any of this.
Bridger was stunned.
We can't leave him without his kit.
The man in the wolf skin looked up briefly, then disappeared into the woods. Bridger looked down at the knife in his hand. He looked at Glass, whose eyes glared directly into him, animated suddenly like coals beneath a bellows. Bridger felt paralyzed. Conflicting emotions fought inside of him, struggling to dictate his action, until one emotion came suddenly and overwhelmingly to prevail. He was afraid. The boy turned and ran into the woods. 7. September 2nd, 1823. Morning. There was daylight. Glass could tell that much without moving, but otherwise, he had no idea of time. He lay where he collapsed the day before. His rage had carried him to the edge of the clearing, but his fever stopped him there. The bear had carved away at Glass from the outside, and now the fever carved away from within. It felt to Glass as if he had been hollowed out. He shivered uncontrollably, yearning for the seeping warmth of a fire. Looking around the campsite, he saw that no smoke rose from the charred remains of the fire pits. No fire. No warmth. He wondered if he could at least scoot back to his tattered blanket and made a tentative effort to move. When he summoned his strength, the reply that issued back from his body was like a faint echo. across a wide chasm. The movement irritated something deep in his chest. He felt a cough coming on and tensed his stomach muscles to suppress it. The muscles were sore from numerous earlier battles, and despite his effort, the cough burst forth. Glass grimaced at the pain, like the extraction of a deep-set fishhook. It felt like his innards were being ripped out through his throat. When the pain of coughing receded, he focused again on the blanket. I have to get warm. It took all his strength to lift his head. The blanket lay about 20 feet away. He rolled from his side to his stomach, maneuvering his left arm out in front of his body. Glass bent his left leg, then straightened it to push. Between his one good arm and his one good leg, he push-dragged himself across the clearing. The 20 feet felt like 20 miles, and 3 times he stopped to rest. Each breath drew like a rasp through his throat, and he felt again the dull throbbing in his cleaved back. He stretched to grab the blanket when it came within reach. He pulled it around his shoulders, embracing the weighty warmth of the Hudson Bay wool. Then he passed out. Through the long morning, Glass's body fought against the infection of his wounds. He slipped between consciousness, unconsciousness, and a confusing state in between, aware of his surroundings like random pages of a book, scattered glimpses of a story with no continuity to bind them. When conscious, he wished desperately to sleep again, if only to gain respite from the pain. Yet each interlude of sleep came with a haunting precursor, the terrifying thought that he might never wake again. Is this what it's like to die? Glass had no idea how long he had been lying there when the snake appeared. He watched with a mixture of terror and fascination as it slid almost casually from the woods into the clearing. There was an element of caution. The snake paused on the open ground of the clearing, its tongue slithering in and out to test the air. On the whole, though, this was a predator in its element, in confident pursuit of prey. The snake began to move again, the slow, serpentine motion accelerating suddenly to propel it with surprising speed. It went straight for him. Glass wanted to roll away, but there was something inevitable about the way the snake moved. Some part of Glass remembered an admonishment to hold still in the presence of a snake. He froze, as much from hypnosis as from choice. The snake moved to within a few feet of his face, and stopped. Glass stared, trying to mimic the serpent's unblinking stare. He was no match. The snake's black eyes were as unforgiving as the plague. He watched, mesmerized, as the snake wrapped itself slowly into a perfect coil, its entire body made for the sole purpose of launching forward in attack. The tongue moved in and out, testing, probing. From the midst of the coil, the snake's tail began quivering back and forth, the rattle like a metronome marking the brief moments before death. The first strike came so quickly that Glass had no time to recoil. He stared down in horror as the rattler's head shot forward, jaws distended to reveal fangs dripping with poison. The fangs sunk into Glass's forearm. He screamed in pain as the venom coursed into his body. He shook his arm, but the fangs held on, the snake's body flailing with Glass's arm through the air. Finally, the snake dropped, its long body perpendicular to Glass's torso. Before Glass could roll away, the snake rewound itself and struck again. Glass couldn't scream this time. The serpent had buried its fangs in his throat. Glass opened his eyes. The sun stood directly above him, the only angle from which it could throw light onto the floor of the clearing. He rolled gingerly to his side to avoid the glare. 10 feet away, a 6-foot rattlesnake lay fully extended. An hour before, it had swallowed a cottontail kit. Now, a large lump distorted the snake's proportions, as the rabbit worked its way slowly down the serpent's digestive tract. Panicked, Glass looked down at his arm. There were no fang marks. Gingerly, he touched his neck, half expecting to find a serpent attached. Nothing. Relief flooded over him as he realized the snake, or at least the snake bites, were the imagined horror of a nightmare. He looked again at the snake, torpid, as its body worked to digest its prey. He moved his hand from his throat to his face. He felt the thick coat of salty wetness from heavy sweat, yet his skin was cool. The fever had broken. Water! His body screamed at him to drink. He dragged himself to the spring. His shredded throat still permitted only the smallest of sips. Even these caused pain, although the icy water felt like tonic, replenishing and cleansing him from within. Hugh Glass's remarkable life began unremarkably as the firstborn son of Victoria and William Glass, an English bricklayer in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was growing rapidly at the turn of the century, and builders found no shortage of work. William Glass never became wealthy, but he comfortably supported five children. With a bricklayer's eye, William viewed his responsibility to his children as the laying of a foundation. He considered his provision for their formal education as the crowning achievement of his life. When Hugh demonstrated considerable academic aptitude, William urged him to consider a career in the law. Hugh, though, had no interest in the white wigs and musty books of lawyers. He did have a passion. Geography. The Rossthorne and Sons Shipping Company kept an office on the same street as the Glass family. In the foyer of their building, they displayed a large globe, one of the few in Philadelphia. On his way home from school each day, Hugh stopped in the office, spinning the globe on its axis, his fingers exploring the oceans and mountains of the world. Colorful maps adorned the office walls, sketching the major shipping routes of the day. The thin lines traversed broad oceans, connecting Philadelphia to the great ports of the world. Hugh liked to imagine the places and people at the ends of those thin lines, from Boston to Barcelona, from Constantinople to Cathay. Willing to allow his son some rein, William encouraged Hugh to consider a career in cartography. But to Hugh, the mere drawing of maps seemed too passive. The source of Hugh's fascination lay not in the abstract representation of places, but rather in the places themselves, and above all, the vast masses marked terra incognita. The cartographers of the day populated these unknown spaces with etchings of the most fanciful and terrifying monsters. Hugh wondered if such beasts could truly exist, or if they were mere fabrications of the mapmaker's pen. He asked his father, who told him, "No one knows." His father's intent was to frighten Hugh toward more practical pursuits. The tactic failed. At the age of 13, Hugh announced his intention to become the captain of a ship. In 1802, Hugh turned 16, and William, afraid the boy might run off to sea, relented to the wishes of his son. William knew the Dutch captain of a Rossthorne and Sons frigate and asked that Hugh be taken aboard as a cabin boy. The captain, Josias van Aartsen, had no children of his own. He took his responsibility for Hugh seriously and for a decade worked to school him in the ways of the sea. By the time the captain died in 1812, Hugh had risen to the rank of first mate. The War of 1812 interrupted Rossthorne and Son's traditional trade with Great Britain. The company quickly diversified into a dangerous but lucrative new business: blockade running. Hugh spent the war years dodging British warships as his speedy frigate transported rum and sugar between the Caribbean and the embattled American ports. When the war ended in 1815, Rossthorne and Sons maintained its Caribbean business, and Hugh became the captain of a small freighter. Hugh Glass had just turned 31 the summer he met Elizabeth Van Artsen, the 19-year-old niece of the captain who had mentored him. Rossthorne and Sons sponsored a 4th of July celebration, complete with line dancing and Cuban rum. The style of dance did not lend itself to conversation, but it did result in dozens of brief, twirling, thrilling exchanges. Glass sensed something unique about Elizabeth, something confident and challenging. He found himself taken, completely. He called on her the next day, then whenever he docked in Philadelphia. She was traveled and educated, talking easily of far-off peoples and places. They could speak an abbreviated language, each able to complete the other's thoughts. They laughed easily at each other's stories. Time away from Philadelphia became torture, as Glass remembered her eyes in the sparkle of the morning sun, her pale skin in the light of the moon on a sail. On a bright May day in 1818, Glass returned to Philadelphia with a tiny velvet bag in the breast pocket of his uniform. Inside was a gleaming pearl on a delicate golden chain. He gave it to Elizabeth and asked her to marry. They planned a wedding for the summer. Glass left a week later for Cuba. He found himself stuck in the port of Havana, awaiting the resolution of a local dispute over the tardy delivery of 100 barrels of rum. After a month in Havana, another Rossthorne and Sons ship arrived. It carried a letter from his mother with the news that his father had died. She implored him to return to Philadelphia immediately. Hugh knew that the dispute over the rum might well take months to resolve. In that time, he could travel to Philadelphia, settle his father's estate, and return to Cuba. If the legal proceedings in Havana proceeded more quickly, his first mate could pilot the ship back to Philadelphia. Glass booked passage on Bonita Morena, a Spanish merchant, bound that week for Baltimore. As it turned out, the Spanish merchant would never sail past the ramparts of Fort McHenry, and Glass would never again see Philadelphia. A day's sail from Havana, there appeared on the horizon a ship with no flag. Bonita Morena's captain attempted to flee, but his sluggish boat was no match for the speedy pirate cutter. The cutter came abreast of the merchant and fired 5 cannons loaded with grape. With 5 of his sailors dead on the decks, the captain took down his sails. The captain expected his surrender to result in quarter. It did not. 20 pirates boarded Bonita Morena. The leader, a mulatto with a golden tooth and a golden chain, approached the captain, who was standing formally on the quarterdeck. The mulatto pulled a pistol from his belt and shot the captain point blank in the head. The crew and passengers stood shocked, awaiting their fates. Hugh Glass stood among them, looking at the buccaneers and their ship. They spoke a jumbled mix of Creole, French, and English. Glass suspected, correctly, that they were Baratarians, foot soldiers in the growing syndicate of the pirate Jean Lafitte. Jean Lafitte had plagued the Caribbean for years before the War of 1812. The Americans paid little attention, since his targets were primarily British. In 1814, Lafitte discovered a sanctioned avenue for his hatred of England. Major General Sir Edward Pakenham and 6,000 veterans of Waterloo laid siege to New Orleans. In command of the American army, General Andrew Jackson found himself outnumbered 5-1. When Lafitte offered the services of his Baratarians, Jackson did not ask for references. Lafitte and his men fought valiantly in the Battle of New Orleans. In the heady wake of the American victory, Jackson recommended a full pardon of Lafitte's earlier crimes, which President Madison quickly granted. Lafitte had no intention of abandoning his chosen profession, but he had learned the value of sovereign sponsorship. Mexico was at war with Spain. Lafitte established a settlement he called Campeche on the island of Galveston, and offered his services to Mexico City. The Mexicans commissioned Lafitte and his small navy, authorizing the attack of any Spanish ship. Lafitte, in turn, won a license to plunder. The brutal reality of this arrangement now played out before Hugh Glass's eyes. When two crew members stepped forward to aid the mortally wounded captain, they too were shot. The three women on board, including an ancient widow, were carried to the cutter, where a leering crew welcomed them aboard. While one band of pirates went below decks to inspect the cargo, another group began a more systematic appraisal of the crew and passengers. Two elderly men and one obese banker were stripped of their possessions and pushed into the sea. The mulatto spoke Spanish as well as French. He stood before the captured crew, explaining their options. Any man willing to renounce Spain could join the service of Jean Lafitte. Any man unwilling could join their captain. The dozen remaining sailors chose Lafitte. Half were taken to the cutter, half left to join a pirate crew on the Bonita Morena. Though Glass spoke barely a word of Spanish, he understood the gist of the mulatto's ultimatum. When the mulatto approached him, pistol in hand, Glass pointed to himself and said one word in French. Marine. Sailor. The mulatto stared at him in silent appraisal. An amused smirk appeared at the corner of his mouth, and he said,
Ah bon?
Ok, monsieur le marine. Hissez le foc. Hoist the jib.
Glass desperately rummaged the corners of his rudimentary French. He had no idea of the meaning of hissez le foc. In context, though, he understood quite clearly the high stakes connected with passing the mulatto's test. Assuming that the challenge involved his bona fides as a sailor, he strode confidently to the fore of the ship, reaching for the jib line that would set the ship into the wind.
Bien fait, monsieur le marin, said the mulatto.
It was August of 1819. Hugh Glass had become a pirate. Glass looked again at the gap in the woods where Fitzgerald and Bridger had fled. His jaw set as he thought about what they had done, and he felt again the visceral desire to strike out in pursuit. This time, though, he also felt the weakness of his body. For the first time since the bear attack, his mind was clear. With clarity came an alarming assessment of his situation. It was with considerable trepidation that Glass began an examination of his wounds. He used his left hand to trace the edges of his scalp. He'd caught a blurry glimpse of his face in the pooled waters of the spring, and he could see that the bear had nearly scalped him. Never a vain man, his appearance struck him as particularly irrelevant in his current state of affairs. If he survived, he supposed that his scars might even afford him a certain measure of respect among his peers. What did concern him was his throat. Unable to see the throat wound, except in the watery reflection of the spring, he could only probe gingerly with his fingers. Bridger's poultice had fallen off in his short crawl the day before. Glass touched the sutures and appreciated Captain Henry's rudimentary surgical skills. He had a vague memory of the captain working over him in the moments after the attack, although the details and chronology remained murky. By craning his neck downward, he could see the claw marks that extended from his shoulder to his throat. The bear had raked deeply through the muscles of his chest and upper arm. Bridger's pine tar had sealed the wounds. They looked relatively healthy, though a sharp muscular pain kept him from lifting his right arm. The pine tar made him think of Bridger. He remembered that the boy had tended his wounds. Still, it wasn't the image of Bridger nursing him that stuck in his mind. Instead, he saw Bridger looking back from the edge of the clearing, the stolen knife in his hand. He looked at the snake and thought, God, what I'd give for my knife. The rattler had yet to move. He suppressed further thoughts about Fitzgerald and Bridger. Not now.
Glass looked down at his right leg. Bridger's tar smeared the puncture wounds in his upper thigh. Those wounds also looked relatively healthy. Cautiously, he straightened the leg. It was stiff as a corpse. He tested the leg by rolling slightly to shift his weight, then pushing down. Excruciating pain radiated outward from the wounds. Clearly, the leg would bear no weight. Last of all, Glass used his left arm to explore the deep slashes on his back. His probing fingers counted the 5 parallel cuts. He touched the sticky mess of pine tar, suture, and scab. When he looked at his hand, there was fresh blood, too. The cuts began on his butt and got deeper as they rose up his back. The deepest part of the wounds lay between his shoulder blades, where his hand could not reach. Having completed his self-examination, Glass arrived at several dispassionate conclusions. He was defenseless. If Indians or animals discovered him, he could muster no resistance. He could not stay in the clearing. He wasn't sure how many days he had been in the camp, but he knew that the sheltered spring must be well known to any Indians in the area. Glass had no idea why he had not been discovered the day before, but he knew his luck could not last much longer. Despite the risk of Indians, Glass had no intention of veering from the Grand. It was a known source for water, food, and orientation. There was, however, one critical question. Upstream or down? As much as Glass might want to embark in immediate pursuit of his betrayers, he knew that to do so would be folly. He was alone with no weapons in hostile country. He was weak from fever and hunger. He couldn't walk. It pained him to consider retreat, even temporary retreat. But Glass knew there was no real option. The trading post of Fort Brazeau lay 350 miles downstream at the confluence of the White River and the Missouri. If he could make it there, he could reprovision himself, then begin his pursuit in earnest. 350 miles. A healthy man in good weather could cover that ground in 2 weeks. How far can I crawl in a day? He had no idea, but he did not intend to sit in one place. His arm and leg did not appear inflamed, and Glass assumed they would mend with time. He would crawl until his body could support a crutch. If he only made 3 miles a day, so be it. Better to have those 3 miles behind him than ahead. Besides, moving would increase his odds of finding food. The mulatto and his captured Spanish ship sailed west for Galveston Bay and Lafitte's pirate colony at Campeche. They attacked another Spanish merchantman 100 miles south of New Orleans, luring their prey into cannon range under the guise of the Bonita Morena's Spanish flag. Once aboard this newest victim, the Castellana, the buccaneers again conducted their brutal triage. This time the urgency was greater since the cannon barrage had ripped open the Castellana below the waterline. She was sinking. The pirates' luck ran flush. The Castellana was bound from Sevilla to New Orleans with a cargo of small arms. If they could remove the guns from the ship before it sank, they would turn an enormous profit. Lafitte would be pleased. The settlement of Texas had begun in earnest by 1819, and Jean Lafitte's pirate enclave on Galveston Island worked diligently to supply it. Towns sprouted from the Rio Grande to the Sabine, and all of them needed provisions. Lafitte's particular method of obtaining his wares cut out the middleman. In fact, it cut up the middleman. With this competitive advantage over more conventional traders, Campeche thrived, becoming a magnet for all manner of smugglers, slavers, picaroons, and anyone else seeking a tolerant environment for illicit trade. The ambiguous status of Texas helped to shelter the Campeche pirates from intervention by outside powers. Mexico benefited from the attacks on Spanish ships, and Spain was too weak to challenge them. For a while, the United States was willing to look the other way. After all, Lafitte left American ships alone, and he was a hero of the Battle of New Orleans to boot.
Though not physically shackled, Hugh Glass found himself thoroughly imprisoned by Jean Lafitte's criminal enterprise. On board ship, any form of mutiny would result in his death. His participation in various attacks on Spanish merchantmen left no doubt about the pirate's perspective on dissent. Glass managed to avoid spilling blood by his own hand. His other actions he justified by the doctrine of necessity. Nor did Glass's time ashore in Campeche offer any reasonable opportunity for escape. Lafitte reigned supreme on the island. Across the bay on the Texas mainland, the dominant inhabitants were the Carangawa Indians, notorious for cannibalism. Beyond the territory of the Carangawa lay the Tonkawas, the Comanches, the Kiowas, and the Osage. None were hospitable to whites, though they were less inclined to eat them. The scattered pockets of civilization still included a large number of Spaniards, likely to hang as a pirate anyone who walked up from the coast. Mexican banditos and vigilante Texicans added final spice to the mainland mix. Ultimately, there were limits on the civilized world's willingness to tolerate a thriving pirate state. Most significantly, the United States decided to improve its relations with Spain. This diplomatic endeavor was made more difficult by the constant harassment of Spanish ships, often in U.S. territorial waters. In November 1820, President Madison sent Lieutenant Larry Kearney, the USS Enterprise, and a fleet of American warships to Campeche. Lieutenant Kearney presented Lafitte with a succinct choice: leave the island or be blown to pieces. Jean Lafitte may have been a swashbuckler, but he was also a pragmatist. He loaded his ships with as much plunder as could be carried, set Campeche ablaze, and sailed away with his buccaneer fleet, never again to be glimpsed by history. Hugh Glass stood in the chaotic streets of Campeche that November night and made an abrupt decision about the course of his future. He had no intention of joining the fleeing band of pirates. Glass had come to view the sea, which he once embraced as synonymous with freedom, as no more than the confining parameters of small ships. He resolved to turn a new direction. The crimson glow of fire cast Campeche's last night in apocalyptic splendor. Men swarmed through the scattered buildings, grabbing for anything of value. Liquor, never in short supply on the island, flowed with particular abandon. Disputes over plunder found quick resolution through gunfire, filling the town with the staccato explosions of small arms. Wild rumors spread that the American fleet was about to shell the town. Men fought wildly to clamber aboard departing ships, whose crews used swords and pistols to fight off unwanted passengers. As Glass wondered where to go, he ran headlong into a man named Alexander Greenstock. Like Glass, Greenstock was a prisoner, impressed into duty when his ship had been captured. Glass had served with him on a recent foray into the Gulf.
"I know about a skiff on the south shore," said Greenstock. "I'm taking it to the mainland."
Among the contending poor options, the risks on the mainland seemed least bad. Glass and Greenstock picked their way through the town. Before them, on a narrow road, three heavily armed men sat atop a horse-drawn cart, stacked precariously with barrels and crates. One man whipped the horse, while two others stood guard from the top of their loot. The cart hit a stone, and a crate tumbled to the ground with a crash. The men ignored it, racing to catch their ship. The top of the crate read, "Kutztown, Pennsylvania." Inside were newly crafted rifles from the gunsmith shop of Josef Anstadt. Glass and Greenstock each grabbed a gun, incredulous at their luck. They scavenged through the few buildings that hadn't been reduced to ashes, eventually finding ball, powder, and a few trinkets for trading. It took them most of the night to row around the east end of the island and across Galveston Bay. The water caught the dancing light from the burning colony, making it appear as if the whole bay was ablaze. They could see clearly the hulking profiles of the American fleet and the fleeing ships of Lafitte. When they were 100 yards from the mainland shore, a great explosion erupted from the island.
Glass and Greenstock looked back to see mushrooming flames bellow forth from Maison Rouge, the residence and armory of Jean Lafitte. They rowed across the final few yards of the bay and jumped into the shallow surf. Glass waded ashore, leaving the sea behind him forever. With no plan or destination, the two men picked their way slowly down the Texas coast. They set their course based more on that which they sought to avoid than on that which they sought to find. They worried constantly about the Carrancoa. On the beach, they felt exposed, but thick cane jungles and swampy bayous discouraged turning inland. They worried about Spanish troops, and they worried about the American fleet. After walking 7 days, the tiny outpost of Nagadoches appeared in the distance. News of the American raid on Campeche no doubt had spread. They guessed that the locals would view anyone approaching from Galveston as a runaway pirate, likely to be hanged on sight. Glass knew that Nagadoches was the trailhead for the Spanish enclave of San Fernando de Bejar. They decided to avoid the village and cut inland. Away from the coast, they hoped there would be less awareness of the events at Campeche. Their hopes were misguided. They arrived at San Fernando de Bejar after 6 days and were promptly arrested by the Spanish. After a week in a stifling jail cell, the two men were brought before Major Juan Palacio del Valle Lersundi, the local magistrate. Major Palacio gazed at them wearily. He was a disillusioned soldier, a would-be conquistador who instead found himself the administrator of a dusty backwater at the tail end of a war that he knew Spain would lose. As Major Palacio looked at the two men before him, he knew that the safest course would be to order them hanged. Wandering up from the coast with only their rifles and the clothes on their backs, he assumed they were pirates or spies, although both claimed to have been captured by Lafitte while traveling on Spanish ships. But Major Palacio was not in a hanging mood. The week before, he had sentenced to death a young Spanish soldier for falling asleep while on sentry duty, the prescribed punishment for the infraction. The hanging had left him deeply depressed, and he had spent the better part of the past week in confession with the local padre. He stared at the two prisoners and listened to their story. Was it the truth? How could he know for sure? And not knowing, by what authority could he take their lives? Major Palacio offered Glass and Greenstock a deal. They were free to leave San Fernando de Bejar on one condition, that they traveled north. If they traveled south, Palacio feared that other Spanish troops would pick them up. The last thing he needed was a reprimand for pardoning pirates. The men knew little about Texas, but Glass found himself suddenly exhilarated, about to embark without compass into the interior of the continent. And so they made their way north and east, assuming at some point they would collide with the Great Mississippi. In more than 1,000 miles of wandering, Glass and Greenstock managed to survive on the open plain of Texas. Game was plentiful, including thousands of wild cattle, so food was rarely a problem. The danger came from successive territories of hostile Indians. Having survived their traipse through the territory of the Carrancoa, they succeeded in avoiding the Comanches, the Kiowas, the Tonkawas, and the Osage. Their luck ran out at the banks of the Arkansas River. They had just shot a buffalo calf and were preparing to butcher it. 20 mounted Loup Pawnees heard the shot and came thundering over the crest of a rolling butte. The treeless plain offered no cover, not even rocks. Without horses, they stood no chance. Foolishly, Greenstock raised his weapon and fired, shooting the horse from one of the charging braves. An instant later, he lay dead, 3 arrows protruding from his chest. A single arrow struck Glass in the thigh. Glass didn't even raise his rifle, staring in detached fascination as 19 horses barreled toward him. He saw the flash of paint on the chest of the lead horse and black hair against the blue sky. But he barely felt the round stone of the coup stick that crashed against his skull. Glass awoke in the Pawnee village.
His head throbbed, and he was tied at the neck to a post driven into the ground. They had bound his wrists and ankles, though he could move his hands. A crowd of children stood around him, chattering excitedly when he opened his eyes. An ancient chief with stiffly spiked hair approached him, staring down at the strange man before him. One of the few white men he had ever seen. The chief, named Kicking Bull, said something that Glass could not understand, though the assembled Pawnee began whooping and howling in obvious delight. Glass lay on the edge of a great circle in the middle of the village. As his blurry vision began to focus, he noticed a carefully prepared pyre in the center of the circle and quickly surmised the source of the Pawnee glee. An old woman yelled at the children. They ran off as the Pawnee dispersed to prepare for the ceremonial conflagration. Glass was left alone to assess his situation. Twin images of the camp floated before his eyes, merging only if he squinted or closed one eye. Looking down at his leg, he saw that the Pawnee had done him the favor of plucking out the arrow. It had not penetrated deeply, but the wound would certainly slow him down if he tried to flee. In short, he could barely see, and he could barely walk, let alone run. He patted the pocket in the front of his shirt, relieved that a small container of cinnabar paint had not fallen out. The cinnabar was one of the few trading goods he had grabbed in his escape from Campeche. Rolling to his side to conceal his actions, he pulled out the container, opened it, and spit into the powder, mixing it with his finger. Next, he spread the paint on his face, careful to cover every inch of exposed skin from his forehead to the top of his shirt. He also smeared a large quantity of the thick paint into the palm of his hand. He recapped the small jar and buried it in the sandy soil beneath him. Finally finished, he rolled onto his stomach, resting his head on the crook of his arm so that his face remained hidden. He stayed in that position until they came for him, listening to the excited preparations for his execution. Night fell, though an enormous fire illuminated the circle in the center of the Pawnee camp. Glass was never really sure whether he intended his act as some type of symbolic final gesture, or whether he actually hoped for the effect which in fact occurred. He had heard that most savages were superstitious. In any event, the effect was dramatic and, as it turned out, saved his life. Two Pawnee braves and Chief Kicking Bull came to carry him to the pyre. When they found him, face down, they read it as a sign of fear. Kicking Bull cut the bindings to the post, while the two braves each reached for a shoulder to pull him upright. Ignoring the pain in his thigh, Glass sprang to his feet, facing the chief, the braves, and the assembled tribe. The collected Pawnee tribe stood in front of him, open-mouthed, in shock. Glass's entire face was blood red, as if his skin had been stripped away. The whites of his eyes caught the light of the fire and shone like a fall moon. Most of the Indians had never seen a white man, so his full beard added to the impression of a demonic animal. Glass slapped one of the braves with his open hand, leaving a vermilion handprint etched on his chest. The tribe let out a collective gasp. For a long moment, there was complete silence. Glass stared at the Pawnee, and the stunned Pawnee stared back. Somewhat surprised at the success of his tactic, Glass wondered what he should do next. He panicked at the thought that one of the Indians might suddenly regain his composure. Glass decided to begin shouting, and unable to think of anything else to say, he launched into a screaming recitation of the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name!
Chief Kicking Bull stared in complete confusion. He had seen a few whites before, but this man appeared to be some type of medicine man or devil. Now the man's strange chant appeared to be putting the entire tribe under some type of spell. Glass ranted on,
For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.
Finally, the white man stopped yelling. He stood there, panting like a spent horse. Chief Kicking Bull looked around him. His people looked back and forth between the chief and the crazy devil man. Chief Kicking Bull could feel the tribe's blame. What had he brought upon them? It was time for a new course of action. He walked slowly up to Glass, stopping directly in front of him. The chief reached around his neck, removing a necklace from which dangled a pair of hawk's feet. He placed the necklace around Glass's neck, staring questioningly into the devil man's eyes. Glass looked into the circle before him. At its center, near the pyre, stood a row of four low chairs made from woven willows. Clearly, these were the front row seats to the spectacle that was to have been his ritual burning. He limped to one of the seats and sat down. Chief Kicking Bull said something, and two women scrambled to fetch food and water. Then he said something to the brave with the vermilion handprint on his chest. The brave darted off, returning with the Anstatt, which he placed on the ground next to Glass. Glass spent almost a year with the Loup Pawnee on the plains between the Arkansas and Platte rivers. After overcoming his initial reticence, Kicking Bull adopted the white man like a son. What Glass had not learned about wilderness survival in his trek from Campeche, he learned from the Pawnee that year. By 1821, scattered white men had begun to travel the plains between the Platte and the Arkansas. In the summer of that year, Glass was hunting with a party of 10 Pawnee when they came across two white men with a wagon. Telling his Pawnee friends to stay behind, Glass rode slowly forward. The men were federal agents dispatched by William Clark, United States Superintendent of Indian Affairs. Clark invited the chiefs of all the surrounding tribes to St. Louis. To demonstrate the government's good faith, the wagon was loaded with gifts. Blankets, sewing needles, knives, cast iron pots. 3 weeks later, Glass arrived in St. Louis in the company of Kicking Bull. St. Louis lay at the frontier of the two forces tugging at Glass. From the east, he felt anew the powerful pull of his ties to the civilized world, to Elizabeth and to his family, to his profession and to his past. From the west, he felt the tantalizing lure of terra incognita, of freedom unmatched, of fresh beginnings. Glass posted three letters to Philadelphia, to Elizabeth, to his mother, and to Rothstorn and Sons. He took a clerical job with the Mississippi Shipping Company and waited for replies. It took more than 6 months. In early March 1822, a letter arrived from his brother. Their mother had died, he wrote, following their father after barely a month. There was more. It is also my sad duty to tell you that your dear Elizabeth has died. She contracted a fever last January, and though she struggled, she did not recover. Glass collapsed into a chair. The blood drained from his face, and he wondered if he would be sick. He read on. I hope it will give you comfort to know that she was laid to rest near Mother. You should also know that her fidelity to you never wavered, even when we all believed that you had perished. On March 20th, Glass arrived at the offices of the Mississippi Shipping Company to find a group of men huddled around an advertisement in the Missouri Republican. William Ashley was raising a fur brigade bound for the upper Missouri. A week later, a letter arrived from Rosthorn and Sons, offering Glass a new commission as the captain of a cutter on the Philadelphia to Liverpool run. On the evening of April 14th, he read the offer one last time, then threw it on the fire, watching as the flames devoured this last tangible link to his former life. The next morning, Hugh Glass embarked with Captain Henry and the men of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. At 36, Glass no longer considered himself a young man, and unlike young men, Glass did not consider himself as someone with nothing to lose. His decision to go west was not rash or forced, but as fully deliberate as any choice in his life. At the same time, he could not explain or articulate his reasons. It was something that he felt more than understood. In a letter to his brother, he wrote, "I'm drawn to this endeavor as I have never before been drawn to anything in my life. I'm sure that I'm right to do this, though I cannot tell you precisely why." 8. September 2nd, 1823. Afternoon. Glass took another long look at the rattlesnake, still lying torpid in the all-consuming state of digesting its prey. The snake hadn't moved an inch since Glass had been conscious. Food. His thirst quenched at the seeping spring, Glass became suddenly aware of a profound and gnawing hunger. He had no idea how long it had been since he had eaten, but his hands trembled from the lack of subsistence. When he lifted his head, the clearing spun a slow circle around him. Glass crawled cautiously toward the snake, the imagery of his horrific dream still vivid. He moved to within 6 feet, stopping to pick up a walnut-sized rock. With his left hand, he rolled the rock, which skipped toward the snake, bumping its body. The snake didn't move. Glass picked up a fist-sized rock and crawled within reach. Too late, the snake made a sluggish move toward cover. Glass smashed the rock on its head, beating the serpent repeatedly until he was certain it was dead. Having killed the rattlesnake, Glass's next challenge was to gut it out. He looked around the camp. His possibles bag lay near the edge of the clearing. He crawled to it, emptying its remaining contents on the ground. A few rifle patches, a razor, 2 hawk's feet on a beaded necklace, and the 6-inch claw of a grizzly bear. Glass picked up the claw, fixating on the thick coat of dried blood at its tip. He returned it to the bag, wondering how it got there. He picked up the patches, thinking that he might use them for tinder, bitter anew that they would not serve their intended purpose. The razor was the one true find. Its blade was too fragile to make of a weapon, but it could serve a number of useful purposes. Most immediately, he could use it to skin the snake. He dropped the razor into the possibles bag, slung the bag over his shoulder, and crawled back to the snake. Already, flies buzzed around the snake's bloody head. Glass was more respectful. He had once seen a severed snake head implant itself on the nose of a fatally curious dog. Remembering the unfortunate dog, he laid a long stick across the snake's head and pressed down on it with his left leg. He couldn't lift his right arm without setting off intense pain in his shoulder, but the hand functioned normally. He used it to work the razor, sawing the blade to sever the head. He used the stick to flip the head toward the edge of the clearing. He sliced down the belly, beginning at the neck. The razor dulled quickly, reducing its effectiveness with each inch. He managed to cut the length of the snake, nearly 5 feet to the vent. With the snake laid open, he pulled out the entrails, throwing them aside. Beginning again at the neck, he used the razor to peel the scaly skin away from the muscle. The meat now glistened before him, irresistible in the face of his hunger. He bit into the snake, ripping into the raw flesh as if it were an ear of corn. Finally, a piece tore free. He gnawed at the springy meat, though his teeth did little to break it down. Oblivious to anything but his hunger, he made the mistake of swallowing. The large chunk of raw meat felt like a stone as it passed through his wounded throat. The pain made him gag. He coughed, and for an instant, he thought the chunk of meat might choke him. Finally, it passed down his gullet. He learned his lesson. He spent the rest of the daylight hours carving small bits of meat with the razor, pounding them between 2 rocks to break down the fibrous flesh, and then mixing each bite with a mouthful of spring water. It was an arduous way to eat, and Glass still felt hungry when he reached the tail. It was worrisome since he doubted that his next meal would be delivered to him so easily. In the last moments of daylight, he examined the rattles at the tip of the tail. There were 10, one added in each year of the snake's life. Glass had never seen a snake with 10 rattles.